Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am your host, founder and CEO, Paul David, and I'm joined today by another founder and CEO, Michael Kistner, the founder and CEO of Akatonics. And today we're going to talk about the future of all optical computing. Welcome to the pod, Michael.
Thank you very much, Paul, and great to be here.
Yeah. Just by way of introduction, Akatonics is pioneering the world's first all-optical general-purpose processor, and I'm going to ask you to explain that to our audience in a second. This is a revolutionary technology that could redefine computing performance for AI, networking, avionics, and even space applications, which is one of my favorite topics. I'm going to bug you about the space stuff pretty soon. Michael's journey to leading one of Europe's most exciting deep tech startups is anything but conventional. He spent over a decade in the German Armed Forces, very service, where he served as an officer before transitioning into cybersecurity. Security research. He later led security software engineering and cyber research initiatives before making the leap into deep tech entrepreneurship. Alongside this, Michael is also a member of Two Hearts, a nonprofit community supporting tech leaders from immigrant backgrounds, helping to build a more diverse and inclusive tech industry. And that's big hearts for that one. We love that. Most recently, Akatonics made headlines by securing a major contract with Airbus Defense and Space and raising a $6 million seed funding round. Well done, Michael. That is a big round in Europe. And that round was led by Matterwave Ventures. The fresh funding will help them scale their team and bring their first commercial product to market next year, pushing forward a bold vision for high-performance, energy-efficient computing that isn't reliant on traditional semiconductor supply chains. All right, that was a big introduction. So, Michael, let's jump in. We want to help our audience understand the field of optical computing. So, I'm going to ask you some meaty questions here. So it might sound complex, but at its core, optical computing is about using light instead of electricity to process data, which can make computers much faster and more energy efficient. So for those who aren't familiar with optical computing, can you just give us a simple explanation of how it works and why exactly it's such a big deal?
Yeah, so the weird thing about optical computing is that it is actually much older than electronic computing. And if you think about optical computing, you would think very fancy devices, but in reality, it's actually fairly simple. So imagine you have a picture and it's fairly blurry, right? In electronic, you would first take a picture, you would then process it on your GPU to deblur it, and then you would send it back to the screen so that someone can see it. In optics, you would just use a lens. So our glasses are essentially an optical processor to deblur images. And that's exactly what it does, right? It does something called a Fourier transform, and it does it completely passively, meaning it doesn't use any energy to do it, which is, of course, awesome. And it does it instantly, so it's also extremely high bandwidth. It's extremely fast. And if you take these concepts and take them even further, you can come to the conclusion, hey, optical processing is a very efficient way to do it. Sometimes it's very difficult. So what we do is sadly very difficult. Optical digital processing, so processing zeros and ones, is a bit more difficult than processing analog data. And yeah, that involves creating an optical transistor, which you then use to make an optical CPU. And that's what we do at Akatonics.
And tell us, like, about the timing here, like, sort of, why would you say this is the right time? You know, we talked about energy efficiency, obviously, but why is this the right time for an all optical processor to become a reality?
Yeah, the optical computer is a fairly old idea. Also, for example, von Neumann, the godfather of computing himself, he holds the first patent in optical transistors or optical process. So even back then, they tried to make an optical computer. And over the course of history, you see a lot of different groups working on optical computing the way we do it. So, for example, the famous Bell Labs, the Bell Labs that created the first components of a computer, they also worked on optical computer, getting fairly close. And that was always the problem, that people got always fairly close because the technology was not yet at that point of making a true all-optical computer. And we finally reached that point, and that is thanks to semiconductor. So the semiconductors we use are also usable for photonics. They're also usable for optical computing, which is just by chance. It wasn't meant that way. And luckily, the industry noticed that, and now we have a sprawling photonics community, and we are seeing the first photonic chips that actually do some processing. And this is the perfect time to switch to a new generation of computers.
We'd love to talk about the skeptics a bit. You know, some skeptics say that general purpose optical chips are still a bit far off. So what would you say, you know, makes Akatonics different, you know, and why? Well, yeah, I guess what would you say to the skeptics?
So a lot of the skepticism comes from a wrong approach to optical computing. When people think of like an optical digital computer or an optical transistor, right, they often think, okay, I need an architecture that looks like electronics. I need the same kind of computer as you have in electronics. I just make an optical version of it. And that's a huge, huge problem, because in electronics, you have these billions of transistors to make a fairly mundane processor nowadays. But that's the wrong way to approach in optics. Optics is much larger. You can't do billions of transistors. As a matter of fact, you can maybe do a few thousands of these optical transistors in a sensible way. And the great insight here is not to try to replicate what we are doing in electronics, but to create a completely new architecture that doesn't need billions of transistors, but a few thousands. And then it becomes not only feasible, but then you notice a lot of things happening that are kind of like side effects. The processor gets fast because now it's a very simple design. So everything that you do, you don't have to think about these weird non-deterministic effects you have in a modern electronic processor. And these side effects actually lead to new applications. As you mentioned, we are in the avionics industry, and avionics needs this type of simple processors that are very predictable, that are very fast, very energy efficient. Sure, you probably have to think a bit differently on what kind of feature set you have. But what it can do extremely good.
That's great. Appreciate your response to the skeptics there. Want to talk a little bit more about your product and your unique technology at Akatonics. Unlike other photonic companies that are working on hybrid solutions, Akatonics is going fully optical. So would love you explain in simple terms how the Akatonics XPU works and what makes it unique.
Yeah, the one big improvement of our technology over the hybrid approach is, by constantly staying in the optical domain, a lot of things get actually simpler. It might be a bit counterintuitive that an all-optical computer is simpler to make than a hybrid computer, but it's actually also a kind of a phenomenon you see in the car industry, right? A hybrid car is much more complicated to build than a purely electric car, even though it kind of seems like a logical next step. So we simply skip that step, and that's what allows us to have this all-optical computer. Okay, it means that we need all optical memory, we need all optical transistors, right, these switching devices. So that does introduce additional complexity. But then you look around and notice, wait, optical memory isn't too difficult. Optical transistors, yeah, you can do that. And by putting that all together, we have our XPU. And this XPU, it can do anything. So it's a general purpose processor that has the capabilities of a regular CPU combined with, for example, AI capabilities. And together you can actually run the same kinds of code you run on an NVIDIA device, but on an all optical computer. And now the actual interesting parts start to happen. Now you have this all optical computer that can do the same thing as an NVIDIA. It can do it faster, more energy efficient. And this is one of our huge selling points, is they're made completely here in Europe. If you think of modern high performance processors, none of them are made in Europe. They're all made in Taiwan, they're made in the US, some are made in South Korea. These are the three countries that can actually make modern electronic processors. And we're the only high-performance computing processor maker in Europe. And that's a very unique selling point, especially when you think about critical infrastructure, when you think about defense, all these topics that require a supply chain security on the next level. And we're basically going to be the only option.
That's really like interesting to think about the geopolitical consequences of raising up this new sort of sector almost, and the, you know, production pipelines and things like that. That's really fascinating. Would love to hear a bit more about, you mentioned that people assume you'd need billions of optical transistors, but Akatonics architecture challenges that assumption. So can you explain to our audience how exactly that happens?
Yeah, the simplest way to think about that is, look at your processors. Look at the processors you had over the past 20 years. Okay, I might be a bit old, right? That's why I can look over the past 20 years. But if I look at my processor from 1990s, right? You're thinking about like early Pentium processors, these kinds of things, early 2000s, the early Pentium processors, moving into the Core 2 processors, so starting to become dual core. But ever since then, they've actually quite stagnated. So every time you buy a processor, you no longer look at the clock speed, right? It's always in the 2 to 3 gigahertz domain, right? You don't even care about it. When I was younger, I always cared about the gigahertz, the clock speed. Nowadays, you don't care. So the processors themselves, they are not getting faster. they are not getting new features, right? It's still the same x86 instruction set you had in the 2000s, in the 80s. So you can still run the same kind of software. So what is actually happening nowadays? And the thing that is happening is parallelism. So you're adding more cores. You're adding more optimizations to your process. And it, those two things you don't need in photonics, right? Parallelization you get for free by having multiple wavelengths, so multiple colors of light. And optimization you don't need because everything is always running at almost terahertz speed. So yeah, for now we don't need optimization. And then you realize, wait, I can just make a processor from the 90s, put it into the modern age, and it still does the same thing, just in the optical domain. And then you don't need billions of transistors, then you just need thousands of transistors.
That's super interesting. And so it also, you know, leads to my next question. How do you make sure your chips remain compatible with existing software workloads? Because there is that sort of compatibility issue to solve for.
Yeah, so the easiest way would, of course, be to implement an existing instruction set architecture like x86, like RISC-V, and all these. We actually, early on, we were thinking about implementing RISC-V to be completely compatible with the modern processors and with modern software. Along the way, we noticed, wait, we can do a lot of things better in the instruction set architecture that takes advantage of optical properties. And so we've designed our own instruction set architecture, which we call RISA, which is short for RayCore Instruction Set Architecture. And this instruction set takes the full advantage of optical computing, but the programmer doesn't even need to know because it is abstracted away. So the programmer programs completely normally in SAS, uses our compiler, and that takes care of the rest. So yeah, to the outside world, if you buy an Architonics device and put it in your data center, in your car, in your airplane, wherever, programming it, you wouldn't even notice it's an optical computer. It's just a processor that you program. You're just using a different type of compiler.
Love that. Thank you for breaking that down for us. So we've gone deep with your product, maybe deeper than some of our audience can comprehend, but I think you did a really good job of explaining it in simple terms. Would love to talk about your growth strategy, your market positioning. Obviously, this is something near and dear to our hearts. We're a growth partner and an agency for a lot of startups. Keeping an eye on that seed funding that you brought in, that's amazing. You know, sort of the contract that you brought in, or the multiple contracts you brought in, specifically Airbus Defense and Space. Congratulations, that's amazing. So that contract is a huge step improving optical computing's real world applications. How do you see Architonics growing in the near future? Let's maybe just think about 2025, and what industries are you targeting beyond aerospace?
Yeah, it might be a bit counterintuitive that our processor, which is a high-performance processor, which has AI in it, right? So you can run AI models extremely efficiently, that we are not targeting the data set. People always ask us, hey, this is a technology that the hyperscalers would love, right? This is what the Google and Microsoft, et cetera, want. But to us, that is an extremely crowded market. Every AI processor company is selling to the hyperscalers. I just saw an announcement today that OpenAI has their own AI processors now for the data center. So yeah, we don't care much about that market as our entry market. So our beachhead market is the edge AI market. And there we have this unique value proposition that our extremely high performance processors are very energy efficient, meaning you can run them longer on a battery. And of course, the value proposition that our processors made are made in a secure supply chain here in Europe. All of that is also coupled with the fact that our processors have unique capabilities, like they are very resistant to electromagnetic interference. They're very resistant to various other types of what you would typically associate with disturbances. So for example, you like space, right? So in space, you have single particle events, which for our processor, yeah, sure. If you have too many, at some point, it destroys the process, but it's not like an electronic processor that you get actual problems when you have single particle events. And that's why we are entering in the edge AI market with our processor. And it also is kind of a cool thing to start with airplanes, right? It's the hardest type of application almost. And then after that, the data center is easy.
That's really, really exciting. It's cool to see the different applications over, you know, the different sectors and things like that. I'd be curious about this, you know, the seed round that you got. What would you say are your biggest priorities for investing that capital into your growth strategy? What are you focusing on? Talk me through kind of who are your buyers and how are you bringing them into, you know, great contracts like the Airbus one?
Yeah, the main buyers of our technology are, of course, the application providers that face a serious problem nowadays. So, for example, with in aerospace, you need extreme energy efficiency. Otherwise, your plane is wasting all this power just to compute, essentially. And you have the same also in the mobility sector with cars. So, yeah, those are the sectors that we are focusing mainly on. And our seed funding, so the 6 million euros seed funding, is aimed at providing our first product to this customer base. So that means to create the first avionic processor and to create this processor platform that also works then in mobility, that also works in space, and it also works in robotics.
That's great. Digging back into kind of the, and we talked about this a little bit with like the flexible supply chains that's not, you know, reliant on geopolitically sensitive regions, put it that way. Talk to me through like the long-term growth strategy. Like obviously you're very attractive to the European and maybe American markets or North American markets because of that. But how does that play into your longer term growth strategy given where you can make, you know, make the processors, things like that?
Yeah, so I often find it a bit sad that when we think of Europe, right, when we think of semiconductors, we think that Europe can't actually scale in semiconductors. There is a certain truth to that when it comes to the leading edge node, meaning anything below a 10 nanometer, so we don't have that here in Europe. Sure, we have iMac, who can, in theory, make that. We have ASML here, who make the lithography machines for those kinds of nodes, but we don't actually have a large-scale foundry to do that. But on everything that is on a mature node, so the older type of nodes like 130 nanometer, 250 nanometer, we actually have a lot of them here in Europe because that's where a lot of this originally started, right? We have all these 130 nanometer nodes making automotive chips. So not the cutting edge stuff, but the very important ones that which we saw in the COVID pandemic, right, were lacking all around the world. We actually make them here in Europe. And so there is the possibility to scale, and we are going to use that possibility to bring the next generation of computing made from Europe. And for our US partners or for our Asian partners, right, we don't have to make it in Europe. I should say that it is that we can make them in Europe, but we don't have to. So, for example, if our US customers, they want US-made chips, then sure, let's go to Tower Semiconductor. Let's go to these partners in the US and make them there. If our Asian partners want chips made in Taiwan, then sure, let's work with TSMC, make the chips there. Because the fundamental technology of our chips is fairly standard. It's not too crazy. Nothing that a foundry would be scared of to do. So we can actually make them all over the world if we want to.
That's a really interesting feature. We'd love to dig a bit more into your personal journey and your background. It's a fascinating one. And you know, we have the pleasure of interviewing a lot of founders and love the ones who have this like very varied background. They've worked on different things and they've kind of pulled it all together into one thing. So in your case, you've worked in cybersecurity. You've spent over a decade in the German Armed Forces and then pivoted into deep tech entrepreneurship. So tell me about the seed. Like what caused you to start Akatonics?
Yeah, so the seed was planted very, very early on. So when I was, I grew up all over the world. Was born in the UK, moved to Germany, then moved to Iran, moved to Indonesia, moved to Singapore, and only then came to Germany, or back to Germany in that case. And had interesting encounters all over the world. The most prominent one was probably in Indonesia. We lived there during the riots of the 90s, and that had a huge impact on us. We actually had to flee from Indonesia because my mother is of Chinese descent, and back then they actually tried to massacre Chinese people in Indonesia, which is of course a problem if you're a small boy that looks very Chinese back in the day. That has changed. Now I look a bit, yeah, undefinable in that sense. And that actually led me down this road of wanting to join the military. To give back, because back then it was actually the German government that came and kind of rescued us. And I joined the military to do military evacuations of Germans abroad. So I joined special operations, spent most of my time there. After that, spent another few years in the intelligence community and worked a lot on the topic of security. And my favorite topic was, of course, chip security. And when you think about chip security, you suddenly start to think about, hey, can I actually make an ultra secure chip? And that led me down this whole rabbit hole of optical computing and next generation computing and everything. And that's how I met Leonardo, because I wanted to know what's the deal with optical computing. And he was one of the most prominent researchers in that field. And then one day during COVID, we sat down in the beer garden, talked about optical computing, and just got started.
I love that story. First of all, I love a good, you know, sort of founder, co-founder story. And yeah, that I started my agency after having a beer with my, you know, my former co-founder. And yeah, I think that's a beautiful way to start a business partnership. And also want to appreciate your experience too. I relate as a fellow person of mixed race heritage and how that puts you in different situations all around the world, and really appreciate, you know, your experience there growing up all around the world. So thank you for sharing that. And also would love to talk a little bit more about your military and research background. You know, I had two parents. One was in the Army, one was in the Air Force. And I feel like they learned so much from that experience and they became small business owners. And I kind of took that and started my own business. But would love to hear how your military and research background influenced your approach to problem solving and leadership.
Oh, yeah, that's a fun question, because military, you always think that, or at least people who haven't spent a lot of time with military people, that they're very closed mind in that sense, right? That they are very non-creative. But people don't underestimate how much creativity it actually requires to be a military leader, right? You have to think of, you're constantly facing problems, and you're constantly facing problems in a high-pressure environment. So you have to be creative, not just to be creative, but when the dung hits the fan, in that sense, right? So yeah, and that actually helped me a lot. So I'm fairly calm under pressure if I have, for example, any types of pitching situations with various investors, right? I don't get excited that easily. I always sweat, because that's just my natural way of facing this kinds of situation. But in the end of the day, right, it's just a conversation. And these kinds of things really helped also with the leadership of the team, with structuring the company. Yes, there is a certain type of hierarchy that people gravitate towards when they have a military background, but it really helped. And furthermore, the German military is very, very open and is very, very non-commanding in that sense. So yeah, you actually have a structure that is far more similar to what you would find in a modern corporate environment than what you would find back in 100 years ago in the Prussian army, for example, right? So yeah, that really helped with it.
That's really interesting. What would you say has been the biggest challenge transitioning from military to research to now, you know, being a founder?
So the good thing is the German military allows you to study at the military university. So that transition was fairly simple. It was actually a bit harder to go back into the military after spending 4 years at university and then suddenly having to crawl around the mud again. That was a bit more tricky. But I also decided to do my PhD at the military university. So I also did my PhD in Munich at the University of the Bundeswehr. And the transition then to move towards a corporate environment, it was new in the sense that I didn't know the laws. I didn't know anything about how to set up a business. That is something that completely lacked. But I did know how to talk to people. I did know how to lead people. And so half of the stuff was easy, the other half was very difficult. Luckily, it was the half that was difficult that I could get external advice, and that's why we're super happy to work with all our early investors, with all our partners and advisors who really helped us with the business side when we could concentrate on the easy stuff.
Thanks for that. Would love to hear a bit more just about that transition and kind of maybe a lesson from your journey that you wish more entrepreneurs knew about. Like, what do you kind of wish you knew, you know, knowing what you know now?
Yeah, I think it's less of something that I wish I knew back then, but it would be more of something I would have a bit more courage to do. So when you spend a lot of time in the military or in government, you get used to being in a very safe environment. You get used to having a safe job. You get used to having the same workspace every morning and that you don't have to think about these kinds of things. I always wanted to actually found a company. I always had these ideas that I wanted to work on and make a business out of. But I always thought, I actually have a good gig here, right? Why do I want to leave this? And I wish I had the courage much earlier. That would have really helped me get to know this business environment early on. Because then I would have founded Architonics as a third company or a fourth company or whatever, right? And I would have avoided a lot of the mistakes that we did in the early days. And yeah, sadly, a few of these mistakes still haunt us to this day, we're getting rid of them, but they could have been avoided.
Yeah, that's always, you know, you kind of, as a founder, you look back and you're like, gosh, like every year you grow so much. You're like, I wish, you know, I shouldn't have made that decision. But that's part of the process too. You got to give yourself that grace and that patience, I feel like. So yeah, appreciate you sharing that. Want to jump to our quick fire questions now. So these are just like kind of fun, somewhat personal, you know, questions to kind of help our audience get to know you a bit better. So, you know, quick answers, whatever comes to mind, you know, try to keep it under 30 seconds, something like that. First question, if you
It would be an accelerator company. So something like the Large Hadron Collider, but on a chip. That's much cooler. So that already exists. I would love to make a company out of that.
That's awesome. Not one we've heard before. What tech invention makes you the most excited right now?
Yeah, it's probably the accelerator on a chip, which would really help with things like making fusion a reality much faster.
Yeah, the fusion thing is very exciting. I was just talking to someone about that. That'll be a total game changer, obviously. What tech invention right now makes you the most concerned?
It's probably, I know that the AI is a dead horse that's been beaten quite a bit, but at the moment it is sadly AI. Not necessarily the chat stuff, but the deepfakes is something very concerning.
Yeah, definitely. Who is a literal human who's been integral to your career journey?
I would say it's my mom. I mean, she's Asian, so she pushes us very much, yeah. So I would say it's my mom.
Shout out to the Tiger Moms out there. What's an inspirational quote that stuck with you through your journey in tech and entrepreneurship?
Yeah, very cliche, but it is, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together.
Yeah, I think that's like originally an African proverb, maybe. It's probably attributed many places. Appreciate that. Well, like I said, this has been a really fantastic conversation. I've loved it because I think Akutonics is a great example of how deep tech can kind of fundamentally reshape computing. And I think you're winning the contracts. You've got a great seed round. You've got a lot of momentum. So it's very exciting. It's not just about making things faster, but rethinking how computing or computation itself works, which is really cool. So just want to thank you for joining us, Michael. It's been a fantastic conversation. Where can folks learn more about Akutonics and the good work you're doing?
Yeah, the best place to learn about what we are doing on a day-to-day basis is probably LinkedIn. So feel free to follow us on LinkedIn and our website, where we at least try to keep our blog up to date. So feel free to visit akutonics.com.
Amazing. Well, we'll leave links to those in the episode description. Folks who are listening, if you've enjoyed this episode, and I'm pretty sure you have, it's been a fantastic conversation, please leave a review for us on your listening platform. Give us a 5-star review so we can keep bringing on more incredible guests like Michael Kistner, founder and CEO of Akutonics. Thanks for listening, everybody. And thank you again, Michael, for your time.
Thank you very much, Paul.